The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is AARP, and annual sponsors include Northwest Nazarene University, Red Sky, and the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Nikki Pantera.
Hello, welcome to today's City Club Forum, Suicide Prevention in Idaho, with Director of the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline, John Reuser, and volunteer Jenny Riley. My name is Nikki Pantera, a past president of City Club, and I am pleased to moderate today's forum. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Rachel Weiner for her help in putting this together. I'd like to welcome our radio listeners joining us over Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout southern Idaho and northern Nevada. A very warm thank you to our exclusive sponsor today, St. Luke's, for sponsoring this forum. I would also like to thank our forum series sponsors and our media partners, Micron, Perkins Coie, and Echelon Group, and our media partners, Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Public Television. Please again join me in thanking Rachel and our sponsors who make programs like this possible throughout the year. City Club depends on their support. For those of you new to a City Club forum, there will be an opportunity to have the speaker respond to written questions. The questions are in the center of your table in those plastic boxes. You can submit a question at any time throughout the forum, and if you hold up the question card, our volunteers will collect them and give them to me. Without further ado, today's topic. We are seeing more and more media exposure regarding suicide, in particular suicide amongst young people. Idaho is consistently among the states with the highest suicide rates. In Idaho, 865 people attempt suicide every year, and it is the second leading cause of death for teenagers. A 2015 report showed that almost 20% of teens in Idaho have suicidal thoughts, 17% make a plan, and approximately 10% attempt suicide. Although Idaho consistently ranks among states with the highest suicide rates, Idaho was the only state without an accredited suicide crisis line until 2012, when the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline first launched. The hotline provides emotional support, risk assessment, crisis intervention, links to services, and follow-up for persons with suicide risk factors. Some brief research shows, however, suicide does not just impact young people. If you visit the website, and I suggest you do, you will see success stories involving a veteran with PTSD, a 34-year-old woman struggling with a cancer diagnosis, and a 90-year-old veteran. These are just a small sampling of the people in our community the hotline helps. Based on these statistics, I would venture to guess each person in this room knows more than one person that is an attempt survivor. If not, more than one person who has completed a suicide attempt. With the consistent evolution and increasing use of social media, more light has been brought to this issue, and suicide attempt and completion rates have continued to rise. In recent years, we have seen videos and news accounts of teenagers attempting or completing suicide as a result of bullying online. Many of us watched or read about Netflix's controversial 13 Reasons Why. As a community, we are too often ill-equipped to address these sobering statistics. The story of the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline is an inspiring one, a story that helps to brighten these dark statistics. The Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline was formed and continues due to a collaboration between numerous stakeholders in our community. It includes funding from the state as well as individual and corporate partners, education initiatives involving the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare, and of course, Janus Inc. Our speakers will talk more about that today. I often say one thing I really love about City Club, and in particular moderating these forums, is that I frequently learn a lot about segments of our community that I had little knowledge of previously. This is certainly one of those cases. I very much enjoyed getting to know John and Jenny a little and learn a little bit more about the work they do and the history of putting the hotline together. Our first speaker is Jenny Riley. In speaking with John and others, Jenny has repeatedly been heralded as a dream volunteer. Jenny has volunteered for the hotline since day one. She has served as a volunteer herself, but also an ambassador for the program and devoted substantial time and resources to supporting other volunteers, training other volunteers, as well as supporting callers. Jenny's here to tell us a little of her personal story today.
Thank you. When I was 12 years old, my mother attempted suicide. From that day forward, and for decades after, I believed that she would rather be dead than be my mother. Even with my own suicide attempt at age 16, I held on to the notion that my mother was choosing to be dead, just as I had wanted to die in that moment. Growing up with a parent who is mentally ill, with no diagnosis and no treatment, is not a picnic. I knew that I was unwanted. I knew that my mother made a decision to end her life rather than stay and be the mother I needed her to be. It took a lifetime of experiencing my own struggles with mental illness and my own suicidal ideation to finally understand the truth. She didn't want to die. She wanted the pain to stop. I didn't want to die. I wanted the pain to stop. After going through the most intensely suicidal period of my life and making it out on the other side, I decided that some good had to be able to come from my experiences. So when I learned that Idaho was starting a suicide prevention hotline, I knew that that was the place for me. I finally had a chance to take my own struggles and turn them into an ability to help others who were dealing with the same kinds of challenges. Along with some great counseling, the therapy that came from working on the hotline really seemed to be working to keep my depression at bay. Life was not perfect, but it was a whole lot better. I could arrive at the hotline feeling low, feeling down, and by the end of my four-hour shift, leave with a tremendous sense of accomplishment, with a tremendously elevated mood, knowing that I had helped change a life and maybe even save a life during that afternoon. Besides the time on the phone, I was involved with other hotline activities, including tabling at many events, ambassador duties, helping to train new volunteers, and testifying in a number of cases for sustainable funding for the hotline. Life was good. Then there came a day when I had a serious challenge to my perception of my own abilities, to my self-image, to my own perceived improvement in mental health. I went home from a very unpleasant experience, not related to the hotline, feeling as bad as I have ever felt. I was shaking, my thoughts were racing, tears were falling uncontrollably down my face. I just wanted it to stop. So in the cupboard, I found some pain pills that had been left over from something or other. Two didn't do it. Four didn't do it. Six or eight did not have me feeling better. I finally took 30. The next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance headed for a 72-hour psychiatric hold in the hospital. The assumption there, a logical assumption, is that I had wanted to die. But the fact is, I knew this time I did not want to die. I simply wanted the pain to stop. Just so you know, that episode resulted in a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which has now led me to having fantastic counseling, absolutely appropriate medication, and I can say from today, it's been over 3 years since I have considered death as an option, and over 3 years since I've had a manic episode, and life is absolutely amazing. Thanks. I feel the same way. Today, I not only know what it feels like to be suicidal, I also know that so often the desire is really not to die. The desire is to feel better. The desire is for the pain to stop. Sometimes it just feels like death is the only way out. But now I also know that there's help. There is a way out without dying, and that knowledge takes me back to the hotline week after week and year after year. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. That was truly amazing. I always love to hear your story. It always inspires me anew. Every year, enough Idahoans are lost to suicide to fill a commercial jetliner. Idaho ranks sixth in the nation and consistently in the top 10 nationally for rates of this preventable cause of death. Suicide is the second leading cause of death in Idaho for all persons aged 10 to 44 and for males 10 to 14. This may sound discouraging, but I'm here with a message of hope today. Historically, Idaho's suicide prevention efforts, while heroic, have largely been the province of a dedicated core of tireless advocates, some professional, some laypersons, most personally touched by the topic in some way, all committed to eliminating suicide in Idaho. They worked collaboratively whenever possible, but due to Idaho's expansive geography, lack of resources for mental health and crisis services, and commitment by state and local government, those efforts could be siloed, duplicative, lacking coordination, and without adequate funding. In the 5 years since I've had the honor of starting and running our first statewide hotline, we've made incredible strides toward overcoming this, and I've watched prevention efforts become increasingly collaborative, integrated, sustained, and properly funded. The hotline is a true public-private partnership. We are incorporated as a nonprofit housed under the umbrella of Janus Incorporated. For over 40 years, Janus has been a highly effective incubator and steward of myriad programs changing lives in Idaho, focused on economic opportunity, public policy, and community health. We are grateful for our many supporters and partners with the hotline. I'd especially like to thank the Idaho Legislature and the Governor for stepping up during the 2016 legislative session to fund a new statewide suicide prevention program to advance our statewide suicide prevention plan, which includes youth education, public awareness, and supporting 60% of the hotline's budget with state funding. This success was the result of unprecedented levels of partnership and the result of countless allies across the state in the realms of suicide prevention, mental health, substance abuse, and national advocacy. Students, business people, the military, young and old, set aside differences to come together in service of this shared vision. One of the most compelling aspects of this effort was learning just how many of our own lawmakers' lives have been personally touched by suicide, or knowing somebody in suicidal crisis, or the death of a family member, a loved one, or a constituent to suicide. The problem has become one that affects most of us. And as with most change, our gains in 2016 required a combination of robust data, personal stories, and human connections in order to be fully realized. Other vital partners in our efforts include the Idaho Division of Veterans Services, the United Way, the J.A. and Catherine Albertson Foundation, Idaho Women's Charitable Foundation, the Lions Club Sight and Hearing Foundation, St. Alphonsus, Span Idaho, the Idaho Suicide Prevention Coalition, Idaho Chapter of AFSP, and countless other partners and supporters over the years. In all of our efforts, the hotline seeks to advance volunteer recruitment, training, and support, outreach, and sustainability, which is why on all of your tables, you'll find outreach materials for the hotline. There are stickers, magnets, wallet cards. I grabbed a bunch of Spanish wallet cards when I packed my box for this event. So if you're going to have to go to our website and reach out to us to get your English wallet cards. Also on your tables are flyers for our upcoming volunteer training session, our fall training cohort, which begins on Tuesday, October 3rd. And we do three of those per year. So if you can't make the fall training, or if you know somebody who wants to train with us, please direct them to our website for more information. We also have a couple of fundraising events this month, a semicolon tattoo event tomorrow at Resurrected Tattoo here in Boise, and a film event at the Flix next Thursday evening at 7 p.m. There are some posters in the lobby as well to learn more about those events. Also, this morning I had the great pleasure to be at the State House with Lieutenant Governor Brad Little, who recited and signed this wonderful proclamation around suicide prevention in Idaho for Suicide Prevention Day, which is today. So many thanks to our governor and Lieutenant Governor. So, as Nikki was saying, the last hotline in Idaho closed in 2006 for lack of funding. We were one of the last states in the country to be without a statewide suicide hotline. In the parlance of the prevention community, we were known as a barren state. A group of stakeholders convened at that time to put together the building blocks for a state-of-the-art statewide hotline in compliance with established best practices and national standards. The model of the former hotline had trained volunteers taking a cell phone home with them. And for 2 to 3 days, continuously, they were the hotline. They would field all the calls. When I was hired 5 years ago, I was committed to launching a volunteer-driven, dedicated phone room model where responders came to the center for 4 to 4.5 hour shifts, one time per week, and were supervised by a master's level clinician or someone with equivalent experience, who silently monitored calls as they came in and coached those responders through difficult or high-risk calls and processed those calls with the phone worker or responder afterward. Our model involves a high level of training, 50-plus hours, including a lot of shadowing and role-play training and mentorship before volunteers actually take their first call. We achieved national accreditation in 2013, a year after launch, and in 2014, we achieved a 24-hour, 7-day service. Our call volume for 2017 recently surpassed 6,000 crisis contacts, and that eclipsed the total number of contacts for 2016. So there's a lot more use of the hotline, and you know, my boss talks about kind of being a concerning thing, but I think it's greater awareness and greater utilization of the resource. Not necessarily that more people are in trouble, but they know how to reach out. The values that guide our efforts at ISPH, Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline, are the recovery model of mental health and trauma-informed care. The recovery model emphasizes and supports a person's potential for recovery. Recovery is generally seen in this approach as a personal journey rather than a set outcome, and one that may involve developing hope, a secure base and sense of self, supportive relationships, empowerment, social inclusion, coping skills, and meaning. And according to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, trauma-informed care is a program, organization, or system that is trauma-informed. It realizes the widespread impact of trauma and understands potential paths for recovery. It recognizes the signs and symptoms of trauma in clients, families, staff, and others involved with the system. It responds by fully integrating knowledge about trauma into policies, procedures, and practices, and it seeks to actively resist re-traumatization. So what does this all mean? It means that we actively recruit persons with lived experience of suicide and mental illness to work at the hotline, both as volunteers and as paid staff. It's been proven that they can be more effective at connecting with and helping people at risk for suicide. But we also have the responsibility to support them. We have a robust volunteer support program, which includes a monthly discussion group for volunteers and staff, a separate Zen space that we've constructed within our center, and all of our volunteers have access to the same employee assistant program benefits that paid staff of Janus have, which includes the provision of short-term counseling if needed. Volunteers really are the lifeblood of our program. We have about 85 highly trained community volunteers fielding crisis calls and texts from our Boise Center, all under the supervision of a master's level clinician and other paid staff. Since launch, our volunteers have contributed over $1 million of in-kind value in the time that they've donated to help people, help seekers reaching out to the hotline. You know, listening is really the most important and therapeutically effective thing that we can do at the hotline. Listening in an open, caring, compassionate, and non-judgmental manner. Our model of intervention is simple, but it's not necessarily easy to do naturally. We avoid cheerleading and advice giving on the line. If we do any problem solving with our callers, it's collaborative and always based on their own identified prior coping skills. A reporter came out a couple years ago and was interviewing me, and he said, "Well, you guys talk people out of killing themselves, don't you?" I thought about it for a minute, and I said, "No, we listen them out of it, is what we do." And our volunteers come from really all walks of life. The youngest right now is 21, although we are now recruiting as young as 18 for our new cohorts as we launch more technologically intensive interventions like crisis text and crisis chat, which will be launched formally by the end of this year. And what do people get for volunteering from the hotline? Well, Jenny really articulated that quite well in terms of health benefits and mental health benefits and meaning. But we also really, there's a lot of value added to volunteering at the hotline. We teach soft skills, listening supportively, empathetically, supporting the emotional content of the person speaking with us. And these are things that people take with them into their job, their resumes. People use their skills with their spouses, they tell us, with their children, with people in line at the grocery store. Several of my volunteers have come to the hotline for a shift and told us about somebody that they encountered out in the world that was at risk for suicide. And they use the skills that they developed at the hotline to do a successful intervention and keep that person safe. You know, we know we're not going to solve anybody's long-term problems in the context of a phone call or a text or chat exchange, but what we're going to do is connect with them emotionally, hear their story, and help them feel a little bit better for reaching out for us. And maybe help them come up with a few steps they can do when we get off the phone to start the path toward greater stability and long-term wellness. We do follow-up as part of our model. If you call and you mention suicide or you're sufficiently high risk, we schedule a follow-up with you within 24 hours. And it's just been the most tremendous and challenging and rewarding experience. I'm so honored to have been able to do this. And I thank everyone for being here.
Okay, first I want to sincerely, from the bottom of my heart, thank both Jenny and John for both sharing your story. I know it really spoke and meant a lot to me, and I think probably everyone else here, and for all the hard work you're doing. So I'd really like to... Thanks. A reminder to our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise Forum on Suicide Prevention in Idaho with Director of the Idaho Suicide Prevention Hotline, John Reuser, and volunteer Jenny Riley. So we have a couple questions relating to teenagers and high schools. One is, what are schools doing to address bullying? And I think related to that, the broader question of what's being done in schools with regard to education and prevention efforts.
Okay. Thanks, Nikki. So, every person, right there, everyone I talk to in a context of a school setting, counselors, administrators, teachers, are concerned about bullying. School districts have formal bullying policies. But really, how it affects us at the hotline is when these kids are turning to us for help, or they're not really getting the help within the established structure of their school. So I can't give you details on what the schools are doing specifically, but we absolutely get many calls from young people that are being bullied, and there's no empirical data strongly linking bullying with suicide, but... I would predict that's probably going to come out soon. There's just, you know, a boatloads of anecdotal evidence to make that link.
A little follow-up is, what are causes of increased suicide among youth? And I think there's a question of, is there an increase or is there just more awareness and it more more knowledge of what's out there?
So the theoretical underpinning of our intervention of suicide, of the hotline, is from a man named Thomas Joyner. He talks about the interpersonal theory of suicide, and there's three parts to that. It's thwarted belonging, a sense that you don't belong, that you're not connected; perceived burdensomeness, that you're a burden, that you're more trouble than you're worth; and then acquired ability for self-harm, which could be being exposed to violent acts, literally harming oneself, anything that might lower one's natural self-preservation instinct against self-harm. And so I would say those same things are fueling youth suicide. And there is, statistically, there is an increase in youth suicide lately. That's supported.
Thanks, Jenny. Did you have anything to add, or...?
Joe's got it. He's the boss.
Here's one you might be able to help with. Is it possible to give an example of a call you received through the hotline? I'm sure there's not a typical call, but maybe an example of what a call is like might be helpful. You probably can't give specifics.
Sure, and we certainly, due to confidentiality, we would not talk about the specifics of any of the calls that we get. Once in a while, you get a call that just really follows the model, that goes just as we're trained to do it. And Rich Rahill, who's sitting at this first table, has one that's commonly used for training where it just went perfectly. So typically what's going to happen is the caller is obviously in crisis, or they wouldn't be calling us in the first place. So there may be a period of calming. We may have somebody who is crying hysterically or having trouble breathing because of the trauma that they're in at the moment. So we may go through a period of deep breathing, of just quietly reassuring the caller that they're fine, it's okay, take as long as you need to. Once we get to the point where the caller can begin talking to us, as John alluded to in his presentation, what we do for the most part is listen. We encourage. We speak reflectively back to them. We try to make sure that we're truly understanding what it is the caller is telling us is going on in their lives. We may ask some follow-up questions. But for the most part, truly what we are doing is empathetic listening with the caller, trying to help them come to a place where they believe that somebody understands where they are. There's a great visual that I first got from John's words, that our caller is sitting in the bottom of a well. And from the bottom of that well, the sides are straight and the sides are slippery and there is no light coming in and it feels like you can never get out. And our job as responders is to go down in the well with that person, knowing that it's not our well, that I can climb out at any moment, but I need to sit in the well with that person, sit with their pain, sit with their trauma, and let them feel supported. Then if we have the opportunity to do some problem solving, offer resources to the caller that they may be able to tap into in their community, we have a great database, and Google is obviously a fantastic database for resources that might be available to them. Talking them through, John said, when we do problem solving, we do it collaboratively. So that's going to mean questions like, when you have felt like this before, what have you been able to do to feel better? So we're really tapping into the person's own history, their own understanding, their own belief in themselves, which we all have down there somewhere. We still believe that there's something we can do to feel better. So that's kind of typically what a call is going to look like.
Thank you. You mentioned expansive geography being a barrier to prevention in Idaho, perhaps also the rural nature of Idaho. A hotline can be called from anywhere. What else can be done to help this issue? And what have other large rural states done?
So I think that a lot of things are underway to help this issue now. You know, there's a crisis center in northern Idaho now, Twin Falls, Idaho Falls. The Boise Crisis Center is set to open up in early December. So having those crisis diversion resources spread throughout the state is really, really important. Increased funding for rural health and mental health treatment is critical. Lowering the barrier for asking for help by reducing stigma through positive messages around help seeking and, you know, sort of the normalization, if you will, that suicide is, you know, it's nothing to be ashamed of to have those thoughts, and it's nothing to be ashamed of to reach out and ask for help. So I think that Idaho is making big strides, you know, with the new state prevention programs, public awareness campaign, and youth education program. They're really doing some things that hopefully will provide some long-term improvement in the picture.
Thank you. One person remarks that suicide is a problem that most people do not want to think about. How big of an obstacle is that attitude in your work, and what are the best ways to address it?
It really is kind of a big deal. People don't like to say the word. And one of the things that we learn in our training is that you, early on in a call, you ask that question very directly. Are you thinking of suicide? And forms like this, I think, can go a long way. We try to get out in the community as much as we can, and we try to say that word. We try to say suicide, and we like to link it with prevention, obviously. Get people starting to think about that fact. When John said most of us, and I think statistics bear it out, most of us have been touched by suicide one way or another. We may have had suicidal ideation of our own. We may have had a friend or family member or an acquaintance or a coworker who has either attempted or completed suicide. We have to think about it. And so that's what we do. We talk about it as much as we can and try to get that thought process going.
Thanks. So a couple related questions talking about funding. One asks, is your funding adequate to meet the need? If not, how much more do you need, and what are their prospects from the legislature? Related, what would the priorities be if additional funds were available?
All right. Yes, the burning question for every nonprofit every day. So as I was saying, we are so incredibly grateful that the legislature passed funding for the hotline, 60% of our budget coming from state funds. And during that 2016 session, we sort of did research the landscape of state funding for similar programs around the country, and we found that was about the rate of public funds for entities like ours. We're always going to be a public-private partnership. If the state, my boss is in the room, so cover your ears, Karen. If the state came to us and said, we want to give you 100% of your funding and make you a state program, I would have some reservations about that, because being a public-private partnership really gives us a level of autonomy in sort of the way that we do things and operate, and the way that we honor our volunteers and some of our fundraisers. Also, it allows us to form these amazing partnerships throughout the local community and the state, you know, with United Way, with St. Al's, with St. Luke's. And we don't just get money from them. We get volunteers. We get our message broadcast more widely. You know, having said that, we do each year need to come up with 40% of our budget from non-state resources, and you know, I'm always optimistic about that. Like I said, we're always, you know, our Venn diagram is volunteer recruitment, training and support, outreach and sustainable funding. All those things overlap for us at the hotline. So wherever we are, we're thinking about all three of those sort of things. We don't always need more money, but we need enough money to operate the hotline, to pay our clinical staff and our support staff a living wage, to implement things like, you know, crisis text and chat, and you know, we're at a place now with our our services. We got an amazing grant from the J. and Catherine Albertson's Foundation in early 2016 to do infrastructure improvements. So we're in a pretty good place with some of the brick and mortar things, but we're always going to need sustainable funding, and we'll spend it on good clinicians, good people to help our callers and our help seekers. We'll spend it on spreading the message and maintaining, ideally the best equipment we can, so that we're providing a really stable platform for intervention.
Thanks, John. Sort of related to that, I know that we talked in one of our pre-meetings about volunteers versus staff, and you had some interesting comments about that. Would you ever pursue, if you had more funding, a fully staffed hotline, or do you value the volunteer approach more?
I would not pursue a fully paid staffed hotline. There is good evidence that proves that highly trained and well-supported volunteers can be just as effective at intervening with people at risk for suicide. There is a sort of shift in the crisis center model away from volunteers and toward paid master's level clinicians across the country. But then the flip side of that is that there's this huge crisis center in Phoenix, Crisis Response Network, and they have like a $25 million budget, and they do things all over the state, and they have a lot of paid people in their shop, but they actually came to the body that accredits the hotline, which is Contact USA, because they wanted to sort of bring things back to that, at least the culture, when you have a volunteer shop of appreciation, of support, of warmth, and that is just invaluable to me versus an all-paid shop.
Thanks. What about weather? Does weather impact the hotline? Or I saw an article that you had a huge spike with the election results. What kind of things impact the hotline numbers?
Well, let's talk about weather first, because that's a little safer area to talk about. When we were going through the snowpocalypse last winter, our call volume skyrocketed. We spent a lot of time talking to people who simply were just feeling so isolated, feeling so helpless, couldn't get out, felt trapped in their homes. And for some, it was just they needed somebody to talk to. They needed somebody to relate with. And so sometimes we would have a 10-minute conversation with somebody who was just like, I am just so lonely, I don't know what to do. And in other cases, it was resulting in more significant crisis and really taking him into the, serious crisis or even suicidal state. And yes, we did have a jump in call volume after the election, and I'll just leave that right there.
Anything to add at all?
Our single highest call volume day up to the point was election day. That was and then that was when the trend started climbing for daily rates of crisis contact volume.
That's very interesting. Thanks. How has the continually evolving and increasing social media presence changed the way a hotline operates? For example, you mentioned text messaging and chat as methods to reach out to people or for people to reach you.
Well, we love social media at the hotline, and we rely on it quite a bit to get out our messaging around fundraising and outreach and just a call to action to use the hotline. I predict that on a long enough timeline, crisis texts and crisis chat volume will eclipse crisis call volume, because that's the channel that people are choosing to communicate with, and so that's where we have to be in that space if we're going to be effective. We're actually talking to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and we're a member network center, and they are working on some technology so that people can reach out through Facebook Messenger, but it comes to us in a different platform that's easier to track than that one. So we embrace it, and that's one of the reasons we're recruiting for younger responders now as well.
Though us old dogs are learning some new tricks.
So here's a question from an audience member. How do you follow up if you feel an intervention has failed? And maybe you can talk also on the other side, just your follow-up procedures that you mentioned with someone you deemed at risk.
So it was a question, how do we follow up if we feel an intervention has failed?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess an example, I'm trying to think of what a failed intervention might look like. Somebody calling with a high level of risk and then hanging up on us, the call ending suddenly. And that's why we have a supervisor in the room who's a clinician who can weigh all the elements of that call, the risk factors, and make a decision about calling a welfare check, sending out the cavalry. One of the things about telephone or crisis work that's not face-to-face is you don't always know what the outcome is going to be. It's very rare that anybody that calls a hotline and the hotline's following their model has anything like a completed suicide with a person on the line. And so I would say that most of our interventions are actually successful because we do keep people safe and alive in the short term.
And we do have a process for following up with callers. We never call back without permission from the caller, but we will if the person appears to be seriously suicidal or really in an intense emotional crisis. We will say, we would love to follow up with you. Can I call you tomorrow? Is around this time of day a good time? And we can check back with them, assess their suicidality again, offer more resources if that's appropriate. So we do have the ability to follow back up.
And I actually keep talking about getting a cowbell to mount to the wall of the hotline when we do save somebody. It's really wonderful and obvious because we all just sort of cheer, but I think we might need a bell to ring because it's pretty wonderful.
That's great. Are there any laws that especially hinder your work that you're aware of?
Recently, the police have decided that pinging a cell phone tower constitutes a search, and so we have to build a bigger case if we're on the phone with dispatch and we're worried about somebody who called us from a cell phone, and we don't know their physical location, and we're asking them to ping towers because now it's a search. It's not just a tactic or something.
That's really interesting. Can you talk about any outreach efforts within the corrections system?
Yeah, I'm excited about that. We have one of our staff members, Andrew, has kind of led the charge. We've talked to the Ada County Jail for a couple years now about how good it would be if inmates could call the hotline for free and anonymously while inside the jail. And so we're making steps toward establishing that program with the jail. There's been a lot of back and forth and technical stuff on their end. But then we were also approached by the head of corrections at the state level who wants to take this program that we're beginning with Ada County Jail and expand it to all of the jails in Idaho, all the county jails. And so I think after the next step after that would be something in corrections. We tried to we would be willing to take PREA calls as well, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. Other crisis centers around the country do that, but they've got that covered at this point.
This person says, I understand that the media seldom reports deaths as suicides. Does that impair the goal of greater suicide awareness?
Of course. It's another one of those times where we don't want to talk about it, and certainly the sensitivity toward particularly family members but also friends of the person who has completed suicide, their privacy needs to be respected. But when you do see the occasional death notice and it's made clear that this person died by suicide, and there's mention of suicide and there's mention of education, and it just means so much. It opens up so many conversations when we really can acknowledge that fact of suicidality. But there's still a huge amount of shame attached to it. There's a huge stigma whether mental illness in general and suicide in particular. So that's part of what we're doing. That's part of what we're doing today, is trying to reduce that stigma, trying to make it easier to say the word suicide.
And the other side of that is, if the media really has responsibility to be proficient at reporting suicide in a safe manner, not giving details about the manner of death, not romanticizing it, because that can lead to suicide clusters.
Sort of related to that, do you have any comments, or have you heard much about the Netflix 13 Reasons Why? I know there's a lot of media attention on that. An easy one.
Yeah. I watched the whole series, kind of binge-watched it in preparation for a social media event that I think KIVI was doing, and it is packed with unsafe messaging around suicide, around mental health, around substance abuse. If your kids are going to watch it, then you should watch it so you can talk to them about it. I think it's really irresponsible.
Thanks. Anything to add, Jenny?
No, I just absolutely agree with that. I was horrified by the whole thing.
This person says, I've read about places where there are a number of suicides that appear to be linked, mostly in students. Has Idaho experienced this?
Yeah, we've had some clusters in the Pocatello area and in eastern Idaho, close to the border, around... I can't think of the little town just across from Jackson on the other side of the mountains right now, but yeah.
Do you know, is there any particular education or awareness surrounding that that's being done?
Yeah, I know that a SPAN chapter, the Teton Valley SPAN chapter, arose partly in response to that cluster of suicides. They're doing really intentional work in the wake of it.
Okay. Is there a link here to the broader question of mental health crisis and how the community should be addressing that? And then I think a related question is, what's the priority and what's next? We've got the hotline. What's next?
I'd say, yeah, absolutely there's a link between suicide and crisis mental health and the level of services that are provided. You know, Idaho is making strides toward with the crisis centers. I know that the local regional mental health team with health and welfare is doing a lot more proactive things, getting out in the community. Crisis intervention team training is becoming more common in Idaho. It's a 40-hour, one-week training for law enforcement officers around mental health, substance abuse, crisis intervention. They get to wear goggles that recreate schizophrenic symptoms for them. So there's lots of good things happening in the state, but we really do need to fund an integrated and collaborative crisis intervention system that is proactive. I mean, the two health systems that saw really measurable market decreases in suicide were the Henry Ford Health System, and I believe the Air Force System. They implemented what's called zero suicide. Thank you. So it involves, you know, flagging patients in that system that are at risk for suicide and following them, between appointments and after appointments. And if sort of the model with community mental health is, if a patient doesn't show up, oh, too bad, you know, we're going to take them off the rolls, they're a waste of time. In zero suicide, if a patient doesn't show up, they're going to have assertive follow-up to make sure that they're okay. And so each of these two health systems that implemented zero suicide are really collaborative. You know, it requires medical records sharing and things that we don't do as much in our fragmented healthcare system. But those kind of things really do bring the numbers down.
Thanks. Here's a follow-up to our 13 Reasons Why discussion. Someone asked, if we were to watch it with our kids, are there resources available to educate us on which of its messages are inaccurate and how to talk about that with our family?
Yeah, in the wake of that, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the Suicide Prevention Resource Center both put out really good data sheets on how to support your children if they are watching that.
Great, thanks. Can you make any correlation between the number of calls that the hotline receives and any increase or decrease in suicide?
Unfortunately, no. No, not at this point. We are one part of, you know, a whole suicide prevention platform for the state of Idaho, and that involves safe storage of firearms during windows of crisis. That involves access to affordable, effective mental health care. It involves support for suicide survivors, meaning loved ones of people who have, you know, people who have lost loved ones to suicide. It means that crisis intervention system and crisis respite resources being available. So, you know, we're one part of the puzzle. If you were to just look at the hotline and suicide rates, it wouldn't seem like we were having a specific impact on the numbers.
What is your biggest challenge in creating and sustaining the hotline?
I guess funding and volunteers. Yeah, we always need more volunteers, and we always want to have sustainable funding. Otherwise, the level of community support has been amazing and broad-based, and those are really the two big ones.
And I think you talked a little bit about this already, but can you talk a little bit about how much the hotline depends on volunteers? I think you told me there's something like $1 million worth of in-kind time committed by volunteers. So how many volunteers do you have? How many do you need? And I think there's a training coming up in this fall, too.
Yeah, we have about 85 current volunteers. And, you know, people are, you know, we ask for a year of service from our volunteers. I would like them all to be lifers. But the reality is that people go away to school, they have family things that come up, and they can't stay with us for the rest of their lives like I want them to. And so there's always folks transitioning away from the hotline, so we're always going to need more coming through the door. And we do have our fall training that begins on October 3rd. There's actually a fillable PDF application on our website if people are interested in getting involved in that. We have a training on that begins in late January, early February, and then we have a spring training end of April, beginning of May. So there's three opportunities per year for people to get involved and go through our training.
And let me just put in a plug for volunteers as well. If any of you are considering or wondering if maybe it sounds like a good idea to volunteer for the hotline, and I can truly say that I mean, aside from parenting my children, I have never done anything as rewarding in my life. To be able to walk away from the call center at the end of a shift and know that you have really made a difference in somebody's life. And as I mentioned before, some days you walk away knowing that you actually saved someone's life. It's pretty amazing. I really have not experienced anything like it and would really encourage you to explore it.
There's a couple other questions about things that result in spikes. So it says, have elections other than this last one contributed to spikes in suicide rates? Are there other public factors that really impact spikes?
Yeah, I don't know of any other. I mean, I'm not even going to say that the election is causal for a spike in call volume. I'll just let people think what they want about that. There's not been any official research done, so. But Thomas Joyner, that suicidologist I referenced earlier, he says that, you know, in times of war, suicide rates go down. In cities where there's been a sporting team that's had a major victory, there's a brief period where rates of suicide go down. People feel more connected. They feel part of something bigger than themselves. And so those are actually protective factors around suicide, sense of belonging.
How emotionally difficult is it to volunteer? If you are an empath, are there days that put you at risk for emotional lows, and how do volunteers help each other through that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it can't help but affect you emotionally when you're dealing with people in crisis on a regular basis. But one of the beauties of the model that John has described of how our hotline is put together is that we do always have a master's level or equivalent clinician who's there as a supervisor. So immediately after a call, there's an opportunity to debrief right away. We do have a monthly evening meeting that's open to any volunteers that's staffed by two master's level clinicians. So we have an opportunity to do some kind of ongoing debrief there. We have access to an employee assistance program. So there's lots of support if you're having a hard time compartmentalizing the calls. I would say for somebody who is particularly empathetic, you simply need to take advantage of those resources. Some of the calls do follow you. Some of them you can leave when you walk out the door, and some of them follow you home and need a little bit extra work. But the resources are all there to support us through it.
This question asks, what would you consider the single greatest contributory that requires more public awareness efforts?
Safe storage of firearms, without a doubt. And there's many things that lead people to feel suicidal and have increased levels of stress, but access to a lethal means that is 90% effective when somebody is in acute crisis and impulsive, you know, that's another thing that's statistically proven to lower rates of completed suicide is safe storage of firearms.
So, a little takeaway. What action could each of us do to eliminate stigma of mental health and crisis outreach? What do you recommend?
Talk about it whenever you have the opportunity. When you're talking with somebody who's in crisis, ask the question. When you're talking with your children about the difficulties that they're feeling in life, ask the question. Bring up the word. Say, you know what? For some people, this can lead them to a place where they feel suicidal. Do you ever have those thoughts? Do you ever have those feelings? Talk to your friends. Let people understand that you are open, that you are one of those safe places that somebody can come to and say, you know what? I'm not okay, and I need some help. Be a safe place.
And lastly, what do you recommend as far as resources for people? What's the best place to go for people to get resources to either support another person or for themselves? Obviously, call the hotline. Mm-hmm.
In addition to calling the hotline, they can go to the Suicide Prevention Action Network website, the new state suicide prevention program website. The Idaho Suicide Prevention Coalition just launched an amazing website with updates on all sorts of things going on with events around prevention, but then also resources to help somebody that might be at risk or to get some help yourself.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for your time today and for all the work you do. On behalf of City Club, we thank you for all you do. Join me in thanking our speakers today.
You've been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is on the 11th of October and features Idaho National Laboratory Director Dr. Mark Peters discussing INL's nuclear and clean energy research, as well as its emerging mission to protect infrastructure from cyber attacks. You can find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org.